Hello, I'm Llewellyn King, the host of White House Chronicle, which is coming right up. But first, I'd like to talk about something that is of keen personal interest to me, and that is engineers and engineering. My father was a mechanic. He wasn't an engineer, but it gave me a love and an understanding for what engineering is, how it works, how engineers think, how they are, in my view, the poets of the time we live in. The great structures they build, bridges, spindly buildings in New York, flood control systems, everything we do, even our automobiles, the airplanes, of course, are constructed by engineers. And generally, you don't know their names. You know those of a few great engineers like Roebling, or Eiffel, but you don't know all the thousands and thousands of engineers, about 100,000 graduate a year, a little more, who go to work and work extraordinarily hard using their brains and sometimes their hands to produce the world we live in. And yet, we don't treat them very well. The fact is, as Mark Goldsmith, a former president of the American Association of Mechanical Engineers, said, we treat them a bit like day laborers. And that is, things get canceled, particularly government projects. They go full speed ahead and then zero. Well, if you're an engineer working on these, this is heartbreaking. You want, if you start something, to finish it. This is your work. This is the work of your life. And we are very discouraging of our engineering community because we start things, don't complete them, for political reasons, for funding reasons, for all sorts of change of policy reasons. It makes it a very tough life to become an engineer. And yet every politician, most elected officials, and many who are not elected, are out there exhorting us to go to engineering school. Math and science, engineering, these are the catchphrases of the politics of our time. And they're right, but you've got to take better care of them. I find that many talented engineers, seeing the disaster ahead, relatively low pay, a lot of heartbreak, get diverted into Wall Street, sometimes get law degrees, they move away. The best minds are not necessarily staying in this critical, exciting, wondrous world of building and fixing things and making lives livable. Somewhat on that theme, I'm very glad to welcome today to the broadcast an engineer, a nuclear engineer. His name is Donald Hoffman. He's a friend of mine. He is the founder of a corporation called the Xcel Services Corporation, a nuclear services company. He is a veteran of the nuclear navy and also of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. So you're an engineer and you're in nuclear, and welcome.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you so much.
Lovely to have you here. Tell me about why you became an engineer. What point do you want to deal with in your day? Maybe slide rules. Now it's all computers, but and logarithms and these things that we don't really understand, but which are so essential to our lives.
My father was Navy for 31 years. He actually flew jets. And because he was in aviation and had pretty much treated me as if I'd been in the Navy all my life, I knew I wanted to go in the Navy and I wanted to go in something interesting. So I found nuclear engineering to be the most exciting of all the opportunities. Hence, I studied nuclear engineering in college and then went into the nuclear submarine Navy.
And the nuclear Navy is one of the miracles of our time. We have how many submarines? 16, is it?
Currently, yes.
And, you know, there are extraordinary things. The great aircraft carrier, the Enterprise, which has just been retired, has 8 reactors on it, which is extraordinary because people love that ship. You could sail that ship into San Francisco Harbor and people would cheer it. But if you went to San Francisco and said you want to build a civilian nuclear power plant, much better constructed in a way, it's not moving and has more ship, people wouldn't have it. How is it that we love the nuclear Navy and we're much more ambivalent about civilian nuclear power?
Well, I believe it has something to do with the record. The nuclear Navy obviously has had no mishaps or nothing that creates any concern about safety or any other operational performance issues. The vast majority of it is maintained within the community, obviously, because we have the responsibilities for a number of different programmatic and process issues where we report them to our commanding officer through the activities on board, and then we have off-site organizations that work with us. But it's really that most of those have never resulted in anything that would have risen to a level to have any concern by the civilian population. Obviously, in this country, we do have the Three Mile Island event, and albeit that because there was zero radiation released outside of the containment, nonetheless, it does raise concern by the population, and that's something that we really need to work harder towards.
Do we talk in the nuclear industry too much about safety? Aviation doesn't talk about safety. An airplane goes missing or there's a crash and there's loss of life. They don't jump up and say airplanes are safe, but the nuclear industry seems to me does that every time there's a nuclear incident, even overseas like Fukushima, and that suddenly, don't we frighten people with our public insistence on safety? It seems to me that a private insistence on safety is essential, but does it help to have this very public safety, safety, safety? When somebody says safety, it's like saying, I'm honest, I'm honest, I'm honest. You begin to reach for your wallet to make sure it's secure. Mm-hmm.
Well, I do believe that there is an overemphasis on safety, and I believe it comes because we believe that we have to provide that in some extent. I honestly think we speak way, way too much about safety, because safety for us is paramount. It's inherent. It's in our culture. We live it. We breathe it every day. And while we talk about regulation, external regulation by a number of different entities and organizations, not the least of which is the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, which is tasked with overseeing all nuclear matters in the United States, ensuring public health and safety, we have our own internal regulatory requirements. We have our own internal processes and mechanisms and cultures and requirements, which are significantly more prescriptive and burdensome than any industry in the world. We drive ourselves to levels of perfection and to assurance related to activities that is not here before ever experienced in any other industry throughout the globe. And I'm proud of that.
Is that because if it went wrong, it would go so horrendously wrong, or that it would damage, even if it went wrong in a small way, like Three Mile Island, small in the sense there was no release, not small in what happened, but that it would damage the rest of the industry irrevocably?
Well, there might be a part of that, but you know, we have so much redundancy and diversity, meaning that we have two or four of everything, and then we have two or three different means of performing the same safety function. So the reality, the loss of any one thing or any other performance doesn't have any impact on our capability to mitigate the consequences of any very, very unlikely event. The issues we have is that everything that happens in nuclear, right or wrong, is blown up. It's made significantly worse than it truly is. So many things happen that give the public, I think, cries for concern that doesn't deserve to have that concern. A perfect example, if I may, is a reporter standing in front of Fukushima Daiichi Unit 4 right after the event, where he reports to the public that today we realize we exceeded 1 million microsieverts. The only thing the public heard was 1 million. Micro means, as you know, sir, one millionth, and a sievert is essentially nothing. So we received
this
1 million times one millionth, and a sievert in the measure of radiation, which was essentially zero, sir. But the only number that the public probably held on to was the 1 million.
I want to talk about radiation in a minute, but I want to know how a big man like you survived in a submarine, and I've known other submarine officers who were also physically large men. You're a physically large man. How you get through these hatches and down these narrow corridors. I've been through submarines, and it is amazing to me that you live on board for so long and get so accustomed to squeezing in and out of small spaces.
It's a learned capability. The fact is, I spent almost 9 years in nuclear submarines, seven of which I spent at sea on one particular submarine, a 637 class out of Norfolk, Virginia. And this wasn't a very large craft as the submarines are today. And we had very small spaces and very small ways we had to run through things. And when we had training and drills and things of that nature, we had to learn to actually run through hatches. Hatches that were no more than 2.5 feet from end to end. And we had to be able to find a way to put our left leg in first, drag our right leg, tuck our head, reach in, grab the hatch behind us, pull it closed, and dog it on the way through.
How tall are you, Donald?
I'm 6'2.5".
And do they ask you, is height, when you're being assigned to a submarine rather than a surface ship, Is height a question? Is that come into consideration?
It didn't seem to be during the time I was coming in, and I'm not entirely sure it is now. And in fact, with our much larger submarines, it's probably even less of an issue. But during the time I was in, there were several men actually taller and bigger than I. So I really think, as I said, it's a learned trait, and you become accustomed to it. You acknowledge and recognize this is a part of what you have to learn every day to do.
And how long were you submerged at any one time?
The longest we were ever submerged without surfacing was 94 days. I was on a fast attack submarine, not a boomer, that went out and actually, went around on station.
That is a long time without seeing the surface.
It was.
Do you get stir crazy? Do you yearn for the sun?
Well, there are those who say that the lack of hair on the top of my head is because of the lack of the sun there, too. So I suspect that maybe there was somewhat of a yearning, but in reality, when you're doing the job and you're really excited and passionate about the work you do, the time goes by, you're not sure if it's night or day anyway, and if you're not seeing the sun through a periscope or through any, since there are no windows on submarines, you just have to deal with it.
I know that a nuclear aircraft carrier, you have about 5,000 people. It's a small city. Uh-huh. How many people on board a nuclear submarine?
Well, on the submarines of those days, we had a total a crew of about 120.
Now it's about 300.
And really, it's a little more. Yeah, it's really between 240 and 280. So, as you can see, the submarines are much larger, they're much more maneuverable, they're much more capable of doing things, and they really have multifaceted tasks and actions that they're asked to do.
In your company, XL Services Corporation, which you developed 30 years ago, how much technology knowledge procedure did you bring from the nuclear Navy, part of your culture, your breeding?
Some of the basis in the culture really comes from that, the concept of verbatim compliance, the concept of making sure that everything's done.
That sounds interesting, verbatim compliance.
Verbatim compliance was a terminology that Admiral Rickover used with all of us, which was a recognition that we wrote processes and procedures and we were to adhere to same. And that if there was something wrong with the process and the procedure was to be changed, not the action that we took accordingly. So that we learned to make sure that everything we wrote, we tasked, we tested, we trained on, we tested on it over and over and over again.
Can we reduce that to sort of very civilian terms? You take an action based on a procedure that is written down. It's not a good procedure. What do? You change the written documentation?
Yes. You stop the process. If you get to a step where the step is incorrect, unsafe in any way, manner, whether it's for the equipment or the individuals, or something that needs to be changed, you stop the process, you ensure that you place whatever you were doing back in a safe condition, you go off-site or off the actual location, change the process and procedure, ensure that it's updated, approved through all the approving mechanisms, and then you go back.
I'm going to take a little break for station identification, primarily for our listeners on Sirius XM Radio, where I'm happy to say we have four airings every weekend. You are listening to White House Chronicle with myself, Llewellyn King, and with my very special guest, Donald Hoffman, a nuclear engineer, veteran of the Navy, and a very successful businessman in the Washington area in the nuclear industry. He is somebody who has no doubts about the need for nuclear and how, and we're going to talk about this shortly, how it is probably being overlooked as a great mitigator of carbon in the atmosphere. This program can be heard on Sirius XM Radio, Channel 124, the POTUS channel, also around the globe. It can be seen on the English language stations, The Voice of America, and on about 200 American television stations. You can see back issues of this program at whchronicle.com. It's on our website, and you can read my articles, some of which deal with these subjects there as well, if you don't see them in your local newspaper. Donald, let's go to the crux here. You have this technology, which you believe in, and I know a lot of people in the nuclear industry and absolute believers, and yet it gets short shrift sometimes in the debate in the U.S. People do tend to think that there's danger in it, that it's a last resort for making electricity, and they overlook what it has done. Now we have, 100 reactors or so operating, maybe a couple less now. And where do we go from here? If we want a carbon-free world, isn't this the answer?
We cannot have a carbon-free world without nuclear. not in our current technological capabilities. The reality is there are other sources which people talk about, wind, solar, other renewables, and they have their place. And certainly those of us in nuclear do not put those down. But the reality is that wind and solar have had tens and tens of billions of dollars put in their research over the last 20 years, and they currently still only provide 4% of the nation's electricity. But more than that, wind and solar are not capable of providing baseload. Most of our policymakers use the
term...
That
is the constant provision of electricity,
yes, sir.
Real-time constant.
Constant electricity of 724 electric generation and delivery. The fact is that so many of our lawmakers and policymakers use the term wind, solar, and nuclear in the same breath, often giving individuals the concept that they're all created equal, and they're simply not. Wind and solar really have to have the cooperation of the wind and to some extent the sun. And they require significant amounts of area in order to do things. For example, 4,000 to 5,000 acres produces somewhere in the neighborhood of 4 or 5 megawatts, or 400 or 500 megawatts. And the important thing is to recognize is that a nuclear power plant provides often as much as 1,300 to 1,400 megawatts in a little less than 2 acres. So you can see the difference,
well,
sir.
If we think about this in terms of wind, in New England, for example, most of the turbines are 1.5 to 2 megawatts. The older ones are 1. A plant like the Seabrook plant up in New Hampshire is 1,250 megawatts, which means you would need, 800 to 1,000 wind turbines, plus when the wind wasn't blowing, some other kind of power plant to make up the difference. That's called energy density, isn't it? The amount of energy. But it's a very hard concept to explain to people that the bang for the buck in nuclear is enormous in terms of energy.
Exactly. The energy we get out of the atom is significantly greater than anything we can get from oil, coal, gas, wind, and solar. But it doesn't mean that we don't believe there doesn't need to be a variety of sources of energy to ensure that we have a complete assortment of mechanisms and capabilities to address our energy portfolio. But nuclear itself has so much to be said for it, and so much more than the fact that it is affordable, available, reliable, environmentally friendly. It is also a huge environmental driver in the states in which it operates. Every nuclear power plant in this country, of which there are currently 98 operating, provides essentially $470 to $490 million of goods and services in the state in which it operates. It also provides $50 million in payroll for the 700 individuals working at the site and the approximately 1,200 to 1,500 at the other corporate organizations. It also provides $21 million for infrastructure, that is for schools, hospitals, police, roads, and things of that nature. And it provides $69 million on average of federal income tax. The boost to the economy, the capability of what nuclear provides is so overlooked because I honestly believe that many of us in the nuclear community are so busy doing our jobs that many times we're not lifting our heads up high enough to say, wait, the people don't know who we really are.
What does your company do? What does Exelon do?
My company, Excel Services Corporation,
provides
nuclear energy consulting services to both foreign and domestic nuclear facilities, whether they're research reactors, enrichment facilities, or power reactors. We help to allow them to enhance safety, improve performance, and reduce costs. So we basically implement initiatives to enhance and improve on the technological designs which are already in place, sir.
Now, when this program is broadcast, I will be vilified because we haven't discussed or explained nuclear waste, or people will just say, well, you're not dealing with waste and you're polluting the earth for generations to come. When are we going to get on top of this, and what is your view of nuclear waste and how we should deal with it?
Everything that creates some kind of energy creates some kind of waste. And obviously nuclear has a unique capability for doing so. That waste that it's producing, however, can be and has been demonstrated to be able to be safely controlled in both individual and collective mechanisms. We safely store our high-level waste at each of the nuclear sites now. However, several decades ago, we proposed having a central repository, not because it wasn't safe to store at the individual sites, but it was more appropriate to store at a central repository. We went about spending billions and billions of dollars to study many locations where we settle upon Yucca Mountain, and Yucca Mountain has the technology to do this. Yes, sir. Yucca Mountain in Nevada.
Let's just go back. How long is high-level waste dangerous?
Well, high-level waste can be dangerous up to 100, and in some cases, hundreds of years.
Not thousands.
No, sir. Simply because the high-level waste products, what they do is they have what we call half-lives, which means
they
whatever
decay.
That half-life is defined as, half of that radioactive output goes away in each of those half-lives. So it's a half, a quarter, an eighth, a 16th,
and
a 32nd.
And yet you have some things that have a very long half-life, like
yes,
plutonium, but that's now a mild emitter, is that correct?
But when do you get to something that's 1,000 years or more, the actual radiation release is almost insignificant from even the highest level of emitter, sir.
The other issue, which is of huge importance, it seems to me, is whether we don't have the standards for radiation too high. They were set a very long time ago when very little was known. Is this an issue? I know there's a lot of pressure on the American Nuclear Society to revisit radiation, acceptable human tolerance of radiation. Is that something that you believe needs to be looked at?
Well, it's something we have been looking at. As you're well aware, when we first started the programs back in the late 40s after the development of the atomic weapon and into the 50s where we were taking technological advances and doing what should have been done, which is the peaceful applications of the atom, we didn't really understand all the things we were doing. And so there were a lot of tests and a lot of activities going on. Now we have a significant understanding of radiation and its impacts on the human body in varying levels and forms. But still, nonetheless, there are differences between very, very intelligent people, physicians, PhDs, those that are studying a number of different things about how we should really address this. And there is an entity or a condition called the linear no threshold theory, which really looks at the activity related to going all the way down to zero. Is a small amount of radiation acceptable? The fact is, very, very many scientists have proven that low amounts of radiation have no negative impacts whatsoever, and in fact, may very well have positive impacts. We are reevaluating the way, however, we speak about radiation, and often it's our language. We speak in a language that's somewhat foreign sometimes
well,
to those individuals.
Well, sieverts, for example, I mean, the
Rim,
public does
sieverts.
These are terrible terms because nobody knows what they mean.
Exactly.
They're not like gallons or inches or mm-hmm. other measurements that we understand. And then there's the issue, which to me seems to be hugely important and maybe not talked about enough, of the role of nuclear in medicine. We know about the x-ray at the dentist, the x-rays and the things that that we come to expect and use all the time. But there are therapies that use nuclear that are very, very important, particularly with cancer. I'm told by MIT that we may now have a larger industry in nuclear medicine than we do in nuclear power. But we don't talk about a lot, and it's got no concentrated center. If I say to you, maybe you'll correct me, but if I say to you, where is the epicenter, Donald, of nuclear medicine, where is it?
The epicenter is really in the nuclear applications for really saving lives, as you said, for cancer and other.
But there's no one place people can go to.
Well, there are a number of high-level places, if I will. You know, there are places in Ohio. There are a number of, you know, Sloan Kettering Cancer Center is one. The MIT Research Hospital is another. There are many. There are American cancer centers that you see that are all over the country. All of these utilize nuclear as a part of their treatment process in activities related to therapy to not only impact the growth of the current cancer, but in many cases actually to detract from it and eradicate it. So I'm proud of the nuclear activities. You know, when you stop and think about nuclear, it's so much more than energy. Mining, manufacturing, agriculture, medicine, as you just discussed. There are so many applications of nuclear so many people don't understand or know about, which is why, based on your previous comment, we are looking to actually change the language of nuclear radiation speak. Right now, as you said, it's in sieverts and RIM and other numbers and other terms that people don't understand. We're going to change it to a logarithmic scale. You know how we actually have, we measure earthquakes on a logarithmic scale. So people know that a 1 or a 2 is not so bad, but they know that a 7, 8, or 9 is tremendous. What we're going to do is equate it on a logarithmic scale for radiation. So we're going to make 0, 1, and 2 something like flying in a plane for 4 hours or standing beside your microwave in your kitchen, and then have other things for certain radiation levels so people can speak intelligently about it and understand when someone speaks about radiation that they truly understand what the relative impact is.
There's a move and a lot of enthusiasm about small modular reactors, smaller than the power plants we have, built-in factories, shipped in modules, so you can have one or two or 20. Is that the future? And when are we going to see them deployed? It's very early days, but it's a departure from where we've been going.
It's certainly a part of the future. I do not believe that SMRs in any way, shape, or form will replace large build reactors simply because of the unique service modem that they provide. But small modular reactors have a unique application, especially for things like our military facilities, our research facilities, and our hardened and very vital facilities. But they also have unique applications where you don't need 1,000 megawatts, where you only need maybe 45 or 50 or 100 and 120, where the footprint is smaller and the economics arguably should be different. So we are proceeding forward with the evaluation, the design of these, the applications for licensing for those with our Nuclear Regulatory Commission and other regulatory bodies. And I believe that we will have a small modular reactor ready to come to start going into commercial operation where we can actually begin building one within the next 2 years. We'd like to see it sooner than that, but we're pushing
start
hard to make sure.
Start building in 2 years.
Yeah, to a point where we can start the construction applications, bringing in the supply chain and things of that nature.
How is nuclear dealing with the fact that in today's market it's not always economic because you have very cheap natural gas, but there's an asymmetry there, as I understand it, in that a nuclear plant will last for 60 years and nobody knows what the price of natural gas will be in 20 years, let alone 60 years.
Well, as you know, natural gas is significantly more expensive outside of the United States than it is inside the U.S. And other than natural gas, the single most inexpensive form of developing generating electricity is nuclear. But nuclear does not play on a level playing field. The fact is that wind and solar get significant subsidies that make it much easier for them to be able to be successful in actually doing the economics and the business aspect of generating and selling electricity. Nuclear has none of that. In fact, it has the counter. Nuclear has laws through the FERC that actually require us to derate our plants, which are best operating at 100% of rate of thermal power, and then the energies given to the dispatcher to distribute across the actual grid, where we have to debase or to derate our power levels to actually purchase these other renewables at costs that are greater than it would have been for us to develop the electricity to begin with, simply because, quote unquote, they are renewables.
In 1 minute, what can we learn from the nuclear navy? We started talking about the nuclear navy. What are the lessons that you feel that the civilian world could learn from the nuclear navy?
Well, I think the civilian world was already learning lessons from the nuclear navy. The vast majority of us in the nuclear community that are older, like myself, came from the nuclear naval community, whether it's surface ships or submarines. Many of the younger folks did not, because they're not serving in the military today, but they're coming out of nuclear engineering schools and other applications, or they're studying mechanical, civil, electrical, or other engineering disciplines. But what we can learn from that is the continuous activity of total vigilance, something we have. When you stop and think about the fact that we've had the one event in the United States when we've had thousands and thousands of years of reactor operation, that's the one thing people talk about. I want people to acknowledge and recognize nuclear for what it does that's positive, all the positive aspects beyond the energy part, but especially energy.
Donald, it's time. I love your passion. Thank you for being my guest.
My pleasure.
It's
thank you.
It's wonderful to talk to somebody with real passion. That is our show for today. We'll be back next week at the same time. Until then, remember, a lot of your electricity comes from nuclear.